Welcome back to Gold Ribbon Conversations, the podcast created to support families fighting childhood cancer in Ireland. 6 children, adolescents and young adults are diagnosed with cancer every week in Ireland. And the Gold Ribbon, which illuminates precious light, love, courage and compassion, is a symbol of strength and solidarity for each and every one. My name is Sinead O'Moore, and it is my privilege to bring you this podcast on behalf of Childhood Cancer Ireland, a charity founded by and led by parents of children with cancer and survivors who know that one of the greatest sources of strength for this fight is conversation. Throughout this podcast, I talk to families impacted by childhood cancer, as well as the experts who care for our children's health, education and happiness. Yes, we talk about the fear and the pain, but we also talk about the hope and the friendship and the community that exists here, because you are not alone. Childhood Cancer Ireland values every single donation while on its mission to help more children, adolescents and young adults survive cancer and thrive as adults, and support all those dealing with the long-term effects of illness and trauma. May is Brain Tumour Awareness Month. So in this season, we bring you some stories focused on brain tumours with medical experts, the survivors, and those we have sadly lost. We are delighted to bring you this episode with Dr. Taffy, paediatric neurosurgeon with Children's Health Ireland at Temple Street. Dr. Taffy is a mother of 3, and here we talk openly about why she is so committed to her work, to her patients, and to fighting childhood cancer. We talk about the intensity of surgery, the team around her, how she has had to learn when to detach from emotion to become super focused on her skills as a surgeon, while allowing her playful spirit to connect with the children under her care. We would like to thank Dr. Taffy for her time and for the amazing life-saving work she does. Dr. Taffy, we talked about what we should call you. You said I was welcome to call you Taffy. That's what everybody knows you as. You are so welcome to the podcast. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. No, it's thanks for inviting me. It's a very important thing you're doing, and it's nice to interact with yourself and whoever else is listening, I suppose, hopefully. It's useful or interesting for people, I think.
You are the first female pediatric neurosurgeon in Ireland.
Yeah.
That is quite an accomplishment.
Well, I mean, there's only 4 of us who are pediatric neurosurgeons. So if you put it in that context, it's like, yeah, whatever. But no, yeah, I get it. It's a big thing. It's something that, as I was training, it was not my aim to be the first of anything, really. It was just, I just wanted to be a neurosurgeon, and it just so happened I got a job before any other girls in pediatric neurosurgery. Now, I'm the second female overall neurosurgeon. There's another wonderful neurosurgeon in Beaumont who just deals with adults. So shout out to Catherine Warren. She's amazing. It wasn't my big aim. My big aim was just to get into pediatric neurosurgery, and I'm delighted to be in the post.
Like it's challenging enough to say you want to step onto the path of studying medicine.
Yeah.
And then it's challenging to specialize in the brain. Yeah. And then it's challenging to specialize in surgery of the brain. Then it's even more challenging to say, yeah, I want to take that skill and that learn, and I want to do it for children.
Children.
Tell me, what was your why along the way? How did you make each of those decisions?
I suppose to break it down, the first why was medicine. It was always going to be medicine in terms of my career. My dad tells a funny story about when I was 3, apparently. I don't know how much to believe this, but apparently I was 3 and he came home after, sounds like a very good night out, and kind of As you do kind of collapse on the floor, and I happened to wander into the living room, and I was like, oh, Dad, are you not feeling well? It's okay. I'm going to take care of you. I'll be your doctor. So he latched onto that. And, you know, I suppose was very supportive in that way, as I think he saw that as my ambition and dream from that moment, and decided that that's what I was going to go do. And then my mother is a nurse. She's now retired from nursing, but she was an ICU nurse. You know, got to the very top of her field, was matron of a hospital in Zimbabwe, where I'm from. So I remember, you know, going and collecting her from work, and, you know, kids weren't allowed in the hospital as a policy. So it was always this amazing place. It was like, oh, where's mom going? I'd love to go in there. I want to see what's happening in there. And I used to love going to the doctor for some weird reason. It was my favorite thing, was to go to the GP. So it was always medicine. Why surgery? I suppose I'm a very practical person. I suppose I'm very hands-on, and I like fiddling with things. I used to take my brother's toys apart and, you know, just to see how they work. So I'm very good with my hands, and I think surgery lends itself to that. I suppose one of the other things about surgery is you tend to get your results almost, not immediately, but you get your gratification quite early on in the process with the patient as a surgeon. Whereas with, you know, other specialties in medicine, it takes a while to see your results. So I suppose I don't have patience. I don't have that much patience. So that's where surgery.
But strong under pressure, because yeah, in that moment, you can see if something is going right or something is going wrong.
Oh, totally. Yeah, totally. And that's the other thing that is interesting about surgery, is you do have to pivot quite quickly when, like you said, when things are going wrong. When they're going right, it's all happy days. You know, you're in your zone, you're delighted, you're singing and you're having a great time. But when they go wrong, you do have to very quickly pivot. And I mean, it happened in a recent case where there was quite a bit of brisk bleeding, and, you know, it's a small child, and, you know, things could go really, really wrong. But yeah, it's a challenge. It's a challenge, which I embrace and enjoy. Why neurosurgery? To be honest, I was terrified when I got my first neurosurgical job when I was an SHO. I was an intern on a Friday in the dermatology ward, and on the Saturday I was a neurosurgery SHO in Cork.
Quite the leap from skin.
Yeah, I was terrified because, you know, like everybody, you know, if you say to them neurosurgery, brain and spine surgery, it's shrouded in so much mystery, and the spine as well, you know. So yeah, so when I got that job, I was terrified. I'm not going to lie. I was just I didn't want to do it. But I worked in Cork, and it was my most amazing attachment when I was an SHO. Probably the best job I've ever done was the SHO in neurosurgery in Cork. You know, they were really, you know, I worked with amazing people in Cork who really encouraged me to get into theatre and operate from a very early stage. I mean, it was little things like closing the skin, which as an SHO is a very big deal. And then I remember distinctly the first day I was allowed to drill a hole in a skull for a person who had a chronic subdural. I was walking on, you know, cloud nine. It was amazing. Yeah, just unbelievable. So yeah, so I suppose that's where neurosurgery came into it. And then pediatrics, I've always found that I find it easy to relate to kids. I love hanging out with kids. I suppose I'm a bit immature in my own mind, so I feel at ease with children more so than adults. And then I think children have amazing resilience. I mean, pediatric patients are just, you should see them. Like, I mean, they go through so much, and you see them 6 months later in the outpatients, and they're walking in after having been, you know, bedbound, unable to move one side of their whole body. And they walk in and they tell you, oh, I'm going back to school, Taffy, and I'm doing this and I'm doing that. You don't really get that much of that kind of a recovery and bounce back in adult patients. So I love that about the pediatrics. So
Is it to do with the fact that their brain is still developing, or do you think it's just a little part of their spirit?
I think it's both. Yeah, it's both, Sinead. So yeah, there is a whole concept of like neuroplasticity and how a lot of brain cells in really young children haven't, I suppose, committed to what they really want to do. So there's that. But, you know, children just have an innate, you don't find a child becoming overly fixated on what they can't do. They find a way to do what they want to do, or, okay, fine, I can't do that, I'll do something else, you know. So they rehab extremely well, most of them. So yeah, there's a lot of spirit that kids have and a lot of positive, you know, they don't know negative yet, really, children. They're I suppose, it's part of the fact that they haven't matured enough and lived long enough to develop that kind of super negative outlook that maybe adults would. But they're amazing. Like they'll go through all their physio and OT without complaining, or they will complain but still do it, you know. And get amazing results as a result. They do very well. It's both, I think, definitely both.
Childhood Cancer Ireland brought the Beads of Courage and Sibling Beads programme to Ireland and continue to fund it. Each bead is a meaningful symbol of courage, helping children to understand each milestone of their journey. This international programme has been proven to decrease stress, increase positive coping strategies, and help children find meaning in illness. As any family who has been through childhood cancer knows, it is not just the child themselves who is affected. Siblings struggle to come to terms with the changes in their family. They are concerned for their brother or sister, and they wonder what it all means for them. The Sibling Beads program allows siblings to work through their emotions and fears during this difficult time. For more information on Beads of Courage, visit our website at childhoodcancer.ie.
And you are a mother of three children as well. So your home and your work life very much around, you know, caring for little children and their needs. That brings huge amount of empathy to your work, I imagine, that you really can put yourself in the shoes of the parents.
Yeah, I mean, I do and I don't, because I suppose I always say, for me to be able to do my job effectively, I try not to, I don't know how to say it. I try not to be the parent of the child that I'm operating on. You know, I totally get and empathize if, you know, they come in and, you know, like a child with a brain tumor, I can say, look, if I was in this position, I definitely wouldn't be handling well at all, and this is what I'd like to hear someone tell me that, look, I'm going to take care of your child as if they were my own. I'm going to do my best for your child and you as well. So, which is what I try to do with my parents or the parents of my patients. But at the same time, I kind of have to be able to do my job properly. I have to, I suppose, it's compartmentalizing between the empathy that you feel for the parent, the child, their situation, but also having to go into the professional focus mode of, you know, what I need to do. Because I suppose if you bring too much emotion with you into the theater room, it can inhibit what you're able to do. So, yeah, it's not that I. Yeah, I don't know. I hope I try. I don't know. My patients might be able to tell you whether I do it right or not, but I try and strike a balance between the two. But yeah, it's hard. It's hard going, like, especially when you have to give bad news about a diagnosis, and worse if there's nothing I can do in terms of an operation, and I'm, you know, people are looking at me going, you know, a child has this tumor, why can't you do something? It's horrific, because I can only imagine as a mom, if it was one of my children in that position, I don't think I'd be able to cope as well as most parents do. So Yeah, you just have to find
part them. Of your passion is you're here to fix. That's like your purpose in life. Yeah. It's like, I want to step in, I want to fix. Exactly. But there are some times where there is nothing you can do.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, there are times you just have to say, look, I can't, because if I try to do something, I could make things worse. And, you know, I've had discussions with people where you're like, I'm really sorry, but this tumor is in the wrong part of the brain. And I think you need to think about what other options are there for managing this, and what do you want in terms of the time that you have with your child? It's horrible to have to say that to people. It's horrible to say that, you know, there's nothing you can do. It's awful. But yeah, I suppose there's things that I can't fix. and I have to accept that. Otherwise it'd go crazy, really.
It's a lot of pressure on a person. I can't, you know, we all have stress in our jobs.
Yeah.
But I often tell myself on incredibly busy days, like, it's not life or death. You know, it's not brain surgery. You don't have that get out clause.
I don't. But similarly, I look at other people's jobs that there's no way I couldn't be a lawyer. I couldn't be an accountant. I'm useless with numbers. I'm terrible with words and stuff. So yeah, I know it is. There are times when it is life and death. And I mean, fortunately, touch wood, I haven't had a situation where I've lost anyone just yet, at least someone I'm operating on. If I intend to have a long career, it will happen at some stage. And I suppose the way I look at it is, yes, it's pressure, but I convert that into something I can use. So, you know, the adrenaline is real. Like, I mean, I operate for, you know, if it's a big tumor case, I'd be operating the whole day, and I usually don't take a break, which people don't understand. Why? Because I'm in the zone. I'm in the adrenaline is rushing and I'm focused on what I'm doing. And it's, you know, I don't want to disconnect from that, because then I have to kind of get back into it again when I come back. It's probably not the right thing to do. But I always try to say to myself, you know, do the best you can. And if, despite you doing your absolute best, if things go wrong, at least hand on heart, I can say, look, I've done what I could. And I think that's kind of what gets me through each and every case, I suppose. And that's what allows me to absorb some of that pressure, I suppose.
Do you have any rituals that get you into that zone?
Pardon?
Do you have any like rituals that get you into that zone? It sounds quite meditative. You're in that zone and you feel your body and your mind and your hands are all just really focused on this task ahead.
I mean, it's a natural it's just I suppose at this point, like, because I've been doing this or between training and doing this job, it's been many years where I don't specifically do, like, okay, so like when I'm before I do a case, I go through it in my head. I do this thing called, it's almost like cognitive simulation. So it's like, you know, airline pilots will go into a simulator and simulate flights and what can go wrong. If, you know, if this happens, what do you do? So it's the same thing I do with each, especially the big cases, elective cases. For a few days before that, I'm going over exactly step by step what I'm going to be doing. If it's going all very right, very well, this is what I expect to happen. And then I also simulate in my head, where do I think things could go wrong and how am I going to mitigate against that? So I suppose it's the first step in getting me into that focused kind of zone. And then when you're in there doing the operation, it starts with, just even the briefing. We do a briefing session where we, as a team, we introduce each other. And now, like, I know everybody that I work with quite well at this point, but you still introduce yourself, and it's part of that starting to get into the focus in the case. We talk about what's going to happen, what do I expect to go wrong, what do we need to have if things do go wrong. And then patient comes in and it's, you know, it's hard when they come in and their mom is with them and they're crying and the mom is, you know, very stressed and everything. I tend to step out at that point because I talk to them before I go to theater, but I tend to step out because that's hard for me to watch for sure. But once they're asleep, then you're planning, you know, you're positioning them. I love to braid hair, like, so girls don't get a big shave from me. They get braided hair. And that's also part of just getting into the flow of things. And mm-hmm. yeah, so it's all a continuous kind of build up to you know, the point where you're actually hands in the brain or whatever, doing what I'm doing. But yeah, I don't have anything else very specific.
But it sounds kind of like you train your brain to yeah. step into that role.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're
yeah.
like, okay, even the introduction, it's like, okay, I'm now this part of me
exactly.
now.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm Taffy. I'm the consultant neurosurgeon. And that exactly, you step into that role. Yeah.
How do you step out of the role?
Yeah, I don't do that very well. I really don't do that very well. I try and compartmentalize between work and home. Obviously, I have brilliant colleagues. You know, my colleagues, Derek, John and Kieran, are amazing. And that's one way of stepping out is at the end of the case, almost doing like a debrief where you go through what happened, you know, and they're like, oh, well done, great stuff. Or, you know, don't worry, that's happened with me, or I had a similar case. And that's kind of one way to start to come out of it. But no, I must say I'm very bad at, I take it home with me. I try and not, like usually after a big case, the first night after a big case, I don't really sleep very well because obviously your mind is racing, thinking about what, you know, could, you know, would the child have a hemorrhage? Will the child wake up? Is, you know, there's multiple things going on in your head. I'm awful at looking at post-op scans going, oh, I could have done that a little bit better. Should I, you know, I could have taken that tiny little speck that's there. I should have taken that. Why did you leave that there? So I'm very bad at coming out of it. My children force me out of it because when I get home, I have to focus on them. So
yeah. They don't care what mommy has just been out doing. They're like, you're home.
Yeah, you're home. You know, we need this. We want you to do this. And, you know, so you kind of step into another role and that kind of gets you out of that one. I suppose I that's something I need to work on going forward for longevity as well, is how to kind of improve that bit of, you know, stepping out of it and kind of switching off and, you know, finding
replenishing
out
because yeah. I imagine that even in that amount of adrenaline pumping yeah. for that sustained period, that can be quite wearing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm wrecked most of the times I come home. It's just like, yeah. But yeah, no, I am the first to admit I do that very badly.
But probably because you care. Like it's all connected.
Yeah, it is.
It's hard to switch off from something that you live and you breathe. And these, you know, these patients, from the moment they wake up, they're little people again. And yeah, you want yeah. to make sure that
they're
it went
okay.
well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, you have the conversation with their parents after the operation. And I make a point of not talking to the parents until I know the child is okay.
Yeah.
Or, you know, because most of my patients will wake up after the operation or have a scan immediately after. And I don't talk to the parents until I know that much, at least.
But they're looking for answers from you. So
I know they are, yeah.
It's respectful that you do that. At least you can yeah. come with some yeah. certainties.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to kind of go, oh, yeah, well, I think he's going to be fine. I think he'll wake up and then the next thing he doesn't. It's just, yeah, that's the worst case scenario. So, yeah, so I make a point of not talking to, and I think it maybe worries parents something. So I make a point of telling the parents, you won't see me until, you know, the very end of the day, once we're done and once, you know, your child is awake, then I'll come in and talk to you. But obviously if something goes really, really wrong, then I'm into you earlier. But yeah.
From what I'm learning from hosting the podcast and having conversations with parents who have been on this journey is that the mm-hmm. diagnosis of a cancer can be really, from diagnosis to action can be really swift,
mm-hmm.
you know, so a trip to into get their eyes checked in a retail store, in a shopping center, all of a sudden is sitting in front of you talking about brain surgery.
Yeah.
You know, it can be really rapid when something is really wrong.
Yeah.
How does the team gather? And how important is it that you all work together so closely and there's trust and to guide a parent through that, to bring them from, oh, I just saw a little dilation in a pupil, to it's cancer. Yeah. It requires surgery.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Taffy.
Yeah, it's well, first of all, I mean, it's the most important thing to be an interconnected and very dependent team. Like we would be doing a disservice to our patients and the parents if we weren't a good team. So I suppose the team is, I'm not the only person in the team. I'm actually, by the end of things, probably the least, you know, well, you know, I don't want to downplay my role, but you know, I can't do my job without, you know, the oncologists who are in Crumlin. I can't do my job without our clinical nurse specialist, Miriam Hunter, who's amazing. I can't do my job without my colleagues, who, like, you know, they give me guidance and I bounce stuff off. So it starts from when we first get a phone call from, let's say, the peripheral hospital saying, there's this child, we've done a scan, we found a brain tumor. And I suppose the first thing is to get them into us, into Temple Street. And I like to meet the parents when they arrive, unless they arrive at like midnight. I'm sorry, I'm not coming in at midnight because I'm useless to anyone at midnight. But, you know, I tend to like to meet the parents early on. And, you know, it's a roller coaster that they've been put on, literally. And it's horrible because they're going up that incline. They're getting to the top of, and you know, they're about to go right down, falling right down. Their world is shattered. And you know, all we can do is give them the support that we can. I think it's important to acknowledge that they are going through something horrendous, that it's not, whilst we may see tumors, you know, quite regularly, for them this is their world changing for good. Like it or not, their world has completely changed. And to get them through that, to get not only them, but their child through that, requires a huge amount of work from people all around. So just even the nurses on our ward, Gabriel's ward, the OTs, the physios, speech and language, neuropsychology, the nurses in theater, the anesthetists, there's a huge team and we all work. You know, that's what I love about pediatrics as well, is that everybody does their best for the child. There's something about working with children where people do their absolute best. Nobody says no lightly. So if I find out I have a tumor patient coming in, the first thing I'll do is go find out what's happening with theater. Can I get space to do this case? Okay. And, you know, 99% of the time it's, sure, Taffy, let's work out, let's see what we can work out for you. So, yeah, I think my patients and their parents deserve the best teamwork possible. And we've got a pretty, you know, there's a huge group of amazing people who deal with childhood brain cancers, for sure. Amazing people. A long list that deserves individual shout out, but it is a long list.
I think it's important.
I'm not the center of it all myself. I'm not. And you know, if I'm talking to the parents, I usually like to have Miriam with me, our nurse, because she's seen this before, or our other nurses, they've seen them before, and they're better at kind of dealing with the emotional fallout than I think I am.
But that's important for families to know, that when they are going through this process, you know, your job, your role, your purpose is you're going to take care of the brain.
Mm.
But there are people on hand to take care of them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
And that's thought of, that's considered, that's being planned for. That they're not expected to deal with this fallout alone, that they will be guided through the process, although swift. But it has to be.
Yeah.
But it's, they are walking into the hands of people that have seen this, have done this, have dedicated their lives to it. Absolutely. And can wrap their arms around the situation and each play their part as best they can.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Because it is very quick. That's, you know, while there can be some symptoms for some time and trying to get diagnosis, what I'm hearing from families is that from the moment that it is said, it's rapid.
Oh, it is. Yeah, it really is. Yeah. They're up to Dublin if they're not from Dublin, but they're in Temple Street, usually within 24 hours of that diagnosis. And yeah, it's a juggernaut. It just, yeah, it's pretty rapid. Yeah. Which is great. I mean, they're getting a great service, but yeah, it's a lot emotionally. It's a huge amount to take on because, you know, most times they have other children, they have their jobs, they have, you know, I hope family to help with all those things as well. But yeah, you're literally taking someone and pulling them out of their life and saying, well, this is you now.
Yeah.
But yeah, you have people to help, sure.
What does it feel like when you meet a child a month later, 6 months later, a year later, 5 years later? How does it feel when you see a patient and you see how well they're doing?
It's pretty special. I'm not going to lie. It's the most amazing thing. And I think that's why I keep doing what I do as well. I remember I saw my very first tumor patient that I did when I came back, when I got the post last 2021. I saw him in the oncology clinic only a few weeks ago. I remember him and I remember stressing about his case, but he looked amazing. He's gone through chemo. He's gone through radiotherapy. Yes, there's a bit of hair loss, but he's growing. He was sitting there, you know, coloring in his stuff. And I remember the last time I saw him, he could just barely sit up. Like, so it's amazing. And I suppose it's a testament to what, you know, if things go right, what, you know, what the outcomes can be. But yeah, it's a pretty special feeling. It's addictive, probably. I'd say that much. Yeah, it's pretty special.
And imagine, like, no better feeling.
Magic. Yeah, it's magic. Yeah, it's like Christmas for me every time I see a child come back in after, you know, months or even a year or whatever, and they're thriving. It's for me, that's Christmas. It's like, yeah, happy days.
We're so lucky to have you. I hope you're happy here.
Thank you. I am. I'm delirious. I love my job. I mean, there's hard things about my job that, like I said, there's stuff that I can't fix, or, you know, I just hope that even in those circumstances that, you know, there's something positive that people get from their interaction with me. And that's kind of something I really want to, you know, make sure happens. So even if they're getting a bad diagnosis and there's not much I can do, I just hope they feel the fact that I care. And I have, you know, it's not just words for me. I really do. I you know, I feel for these kids and their parents. I really do. But yeah, no, I love my job. It's challenging. I found a couple of gray hairs just here. but that's what hairdressers are for. But like I said, I thrive on the highs. I thrive on the lows as well, I suppose. I love my job and I'm here to stay. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks,
and your supportive words for any family who is going through this, about to go through it, has just gone through it. I think getting to see the personal side of the people doing the jobs is a real comfort. There's so much intimidation and it's such a new world for people. As you said, like you see medicine, you know medicine, but for families that have been plucked out of their lives and into this world, it can be hard to know and to trust who you are, you know, how who you are as people, I think, is a real way of breaking down those barriers and intimidation and having them feel just that little bit of extra comfort and trust.
Yeah, Yeah, and if that happens, I mean, I'm delighted. That's job done.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Sinead. Lovely, lovely meeting you.
Thank you for listening to this Gold Ribbon Conversation. There are more Gold Ribbon stories written by those fighting childhood cancer on our website, childhoodcancer.ie, and you'll find a link in our show notes. If you can, we would love you to share this podcast across social media using hashtag Gold Ribbon Conversations, as it can help more families to discover this show. This podcast was produced by The Brand Story for Childhood Cancer Ireland, hosted by Sinead O'Moore, and sound production by Alan Breslin.